Most of the time, childbirth happens in a hospital, but not always. Consider the pregnant woman in Payson, Utah, who went into Walmart early on a Sunday morning just to pick up a few things. This was her third pregnancy, so she was familiar with what to expect. But by the time she finished shopping and was at the register, she was on her knees and holding her stomach in serious distress. The baby was not going to wait. The manager and other employees were trying to help her to get her to a more comfortable place with a little bit of privacy, but they were surprised when the woman insisted on paying for her items first. The manager said, "She paid, then she had the baby. You can't make that up." The employees have since named Register 11 the Baby Register. Mother and baby were eventually brought to the hospital and were doing fine. But that's the way it is sometimes with babies. When the time comes, they are going to make their appearance into the world, no matter when or where that might be. Karen knows all about that. And so does Alfred, her father-in-law. Real people in unreal situations.
There is a girl hanging by her broken leg from the telephone wire.
And I called 911 and I said, "I found a baby."
I turned around. I see a gun pointed at me close enough I could touch it.
She would hold our heads underwater all the time.
He levels the gun, pulls the trigger, and I go down.
Her eyes were full of tears. She didn't want to leave us.
My hair catches on fire.
I swear to God, this image is burning my head for the rest of my life.
I'm Scott Johnson, and this is What Was That Like?
Imagine unlocking a version of yourself that's unstoppable, where mental barriers no longer hold you back. Listen to Mentally Stronger with me, Amy Morin, therapist and international best-selling author, here to guide you on a journey to reaching your greatest potential. Every Monday, I bring you into conversations with some of the most fascinating minds, experts, authors, entrepreneurs, athletes, and musicians. They don't just share stories, they reveal the mental strategies that propelled them to the top. But here's the real magic. At the end of each episode, I break down their wisdom into practical therapist-approved advice. In my solo episodes, I dive deep into the techniques that build mental strength. It's like having your own personal therapy session as you discover how to turn these insights into steps you can take right now. This podcast isn't just for those facing mental health challenges. It's for anyone who wants to push their limits, achieve peak performance, and truly thrive. Are you ready to unlock your full potential? Then it's time to become mentally stronger. Subscribe to Mentally Stronger with therapist Amy Morin, available wherever you love to listen to podcasts.
Listen up, true crime fans.
There's a big murder trial underway.
Dateline is launching a new podcast with Andrea Canning.
Welcome to Dateline True Crime Weekly.
We'll cover breaking crime news around the country with the best reporters on the case, NBC News analysts, and Dateline producers on the ground.
Over. Break it down for us.
You'll get behind-the-scenes scoops from crime scenes to courtrooms.
So tell us what he said.
Listen to Dateline True Crime Weekly now and catch new episodes every Thursday.
Wherever you get your podcasts.
You found out that you were pregnant on Christmas Day, 2022. Was that a surprise or were you planning that?
It was planned in that we wanted to have a second child and we were trying since July of that year, but it was a surprise because we did not expect it to happen so soon. We were having problems with conceiving our first child, so it took more than a year the first time. And then it's half that time, the second one. It was kind of fun because, I had my fingers crossed the whole month prior because like, I missed my period on Thanksgiving Day, or the first day of your last period is Thanksgiving Day. And then Christmas Day, I should have, but I did not. And so I was able to wake up my husband like, look, it's a positive test. I'm pregnant.
Can you give us a summary of how the pregnancy was going? I mean, it's a pretty hot summer in Texas.
Yes. It's miserable being pregnant in Texas during the summer, because my other pregnancy was also during the summer, but she was a July baby at the beginning of July, so I didn't have to endure the hottest part of the summer. I was expecting to be pregnant all of August, but anyway, I pretty much stayed inside as often as I could. I would go out for walks like between 8 or 10 in the morning, and after that, I had to take shelter inside because every inch of me would be covered in sweat, just like walking through the parking lot to get to Walmart or going into work. It was disgusting.
Now, as you mentioned, this was obviously, it's not your first pregnancy. Did you feel like you kind of pretty much knew what to expect, though?
Yes, I'd actually say this pregnancy was a little easier than the first one. I guess your body just like figures it out. It was the first time I was carrying a lot of extra fluid. And well, actually, now I think about it, I had gestational diabetes this time. I didn't have it the first time. So in that way, it was worse. I didn't expect to have gestational diabetes. I thought I'd completely dodged that bullet, even though my mom had had it and my younger sister had had it.
Your first delivery was a C-section.
Not purposefully. It was originally going to be a vaginal delivery. We're hoping rather uneventful as they go. But then after so many hours of active labor and the nurse turning Ellie inside me, and it ended up being an emergency C-section just because the story, which is still confusing to me, like at one point they thought that the cord was wrapped around her. At another point, it was just because her head was stuck. I'm not sure, but at one point they realized a C-section had to happen and they asked me if that was okay. And I said yes. And then I pretty much passed out after that. They didn't need to knock me out with any more drugs. I was just so exhausted from pushing that I was done.
And that was your first child. As you mentioned, your daughter, her name is Ellie. And how old is she now?
She's 3 years. So she was born right in the middle of the lockdown. Before they would even, you know, talk to us, pretty much, they had to check to make sure we didn't have COVID.
So now you're pregnant with your second child. Did you know the sex of the new baby ahead of time?
Yes, we did know it was going to be a boy. The technician, the sonogram technician, had a very unique way of revealing that information, because she asked us if we wanted it to be a surprise. And we said no, and we talked about how Ellie was potty training, and she said, well, with this one, he's going to ask you to wipe his balls. I'm like, well, that's good to know.
That seems kind of random.
Yeah. Well, we were complaining like Ellie doesn't like to wipe, but I think that's just common when kids are learning how to use the potty. But, you know, like, I don't know. I was a little taken aback by the vulgarity of it, but maybe I'm just a prude.
All right. Well, let's talk about what happened on that day. You were on your way to work. Talk about, you know, where you work and what happened.
That week, we were doing staff development like all week. I work at a middle school here in Princeton. I am the library lady. I'm not officially allowed to call myself a librarian since I don't have that particular master's degree. I had been feeling Braxton Hicks, you know, the practice labor for most of that day. It wasn't so bad in the morning. It became progressively worse, or at least in my mind, it was still practice labor. I dropped Ellie off at my in-laws for them to watch her while I was at work. We were doing staff development that particular day. I think it was supposed to be team building exercises. My false labor, or practice labor, as others call it, was giving me problems in participating in some of these team building activities. And in the end, like, I asked my principal if I could just sit out, because a lot of these activities involve moving quickly, because they were minute to win it kind of things. Running from one end of a table to another. And some of them also involved eating like gummy bears or whatever. And with my gestational diabetes, I couldn't really participate in that regard either.
On this day, how far out were you from your projected delivery date?
I was 36 weeks and I think 5 days. I was almost 37 weeks. So that's almost full term, but not quite.
But you're getting close, though.
Yeah, and I was pretty big, too. A lot of my coworkers, when they saw me, they were surprised that I hadn't already gone on FMLA or had the baby. I remember at the end of the previous school year, a lot of them were like, are you actually going to make it to the end of your term? Are you sure you're not going to pop any moment now?
And what made you think this was false labor and not the real thing?
I guess because in my mind, there was absolutely no way he would be coming that early. It didn't in my wildest dreams think that it could possibly be true labor, especially since like the last time when I had Ellie, the pain was very intense and I could hardly move. But these, like, I was able to still, like, I was able to push around the book cart and I was able to shelve books and lift a few boxes and nothing too heavy that I'm not supposed to lift while that pregnant, but I was still really functional and upright. So around 4 o'clock or so, I decided to leave to go get Ellie, and the labor pains had gotten a little more intense, but I was still determined to get things just so before I left for the end of the day. I think that's a big problem a lot of people have in the education field is like they just can't tear themselves away from the job. So I decided to move one last box of stuff to my car that I didn't want to leave in my office. And I realized belatedly that practice labor is supposed to stop, or so they say, when you stand up or when you change positions. And this wasn't. So as I was wheeling my cart outside, I felt a little better in the sun, having the heat on me. But then when I came back inside to the sheer chill of the library, it hurt a lot. And I realized that something was wrong. Think about it now. Obviously, I was going into labor, but at that point, I thought, oh my gosh, maybe I'm one of those rare miscarriages that happens in the third trimester, because I have had a miscarriage before, but that was in the first trimester. I gather up my stuff and I head out to my car. And when I sit in my car, the pain is still there. I mean, it's not consistent. It comes in waves, but it was getting more and more intense. And by the time that I'd driven my car a couple blocks over, I called my husband and told him that something was wrong, that I was in a lot of pain. And I could hear him on the phone distracted by repairing some car. He wasn't really taking me seriously. I could just hear it in his voice. But he told me that I should call his parents and let them know that I was going to drive straight home. I wouldn't be able to pick up Ellie, that either they'll need to drop her off or I could get her later. And he advised me to call my doctor. I managed to drive home because I had told him the pain was so bad that I didn't think I'd be able to even drive over to his parents' house. But luckily, our house was pretty close to my work. So I managed to drive home and I got inside and I tried to call my doctor. I don't know what's wrong with their phones. I tried a couple times and I just couldn't get through to them. I just kept feeling this need to push. And I thought, well, maybe I'm constipated, because that happens. It's, you know, pregnancy does anything and everything under the sun to you. So
you were in some serious denial here at this point, it sounds like.
I just like could not fathom, like, there's no way I would have such a preterm baby. There's no way I could. Ellie was only a few days early from when I was supposed to be induced, but this was like 3 or 4 weeks from my expected due date. So at the time, I thought it was maybe I'm constipated. So I go to the bathroom and that's not it. I call my husband back, and by this time, the pain is so intense that I'm almost screaming at him, like the gutturalness to my voice. And he's finally taking me seriously, because I actually have a pretty high pain tolerance. So he told me that I need to go to the hospital, because I guess I was just so in denial that I didn't think I needed to go. I just... needed some other solution. I don't know. Should I lay down? Should I put an ice pack on it? What? Tell me what to do. So we decided I should go to the hospital. But obviously at this point, I could not drive myself. So he asked me if his parents should come drive me.
And why wouldn't Jared just drive you there?
He works on the other side of town in Texas. Like, all these towns are just shoved together, and it takes so long to get from one to the others, even though Plano is like two or three towns over and there's a highway practically connecting us. It takes like an hour, hour and a half with traffic just to get from one end to the other.
So there wasn't time for him to get there.
Not with the way that this labor was going. It did not feel like he would make it in time.
So he suggested that one of his parents could drive you to the hospital. And what was your reaction to that?
I accepted the idea right away. I said yes, that he should call them and ask one of them to drive me. But normally I don't like accepting a whole lot of help from them because, for one thing, I don't like to feel too indebted. I feel guilty for accepting too much generosity, but his parents also have a habit of being overly generous, where it almost feels like they don't recognize that we're adults, that we're still kids, and they're not really capable of caring for our own family.
So the fact that you agreed to that right away, that must have made Jared realize, okay, this is serious.
Yeah, it was definitely a red flag to him. We hung up, and I grabbed my keys to lock the front door, and I grabbed my phone, and I think the only other thing was I changed my shirt because I didn't want to like go to the hospital and ruin my perfectly good work shirt. When you go to the hospital like this, you pretty much expect like all your clothes are going to be ruined.
They might even be cut off of you.
Yes. Yes. I wait on the patio for one of them to come drive up and get me. And I'm still experiencing these waves of pain. And it's hard to be quiet. The pain was so bad, but I didn't want my neighbors to hear. I didn't want this to be reported on like our neighborhood Facebook group or something. Like, did you hear the screaming at 4:30 or so? Should we call the cops? So I was trying to avoid any good Samaritans that might be within earshot. And then Alfred rolls up in his Subaru Forester and he tries to help me into the car.
And this is your father-in-law?
Yes.
Okay. Did you know that it was him coming instead of Carolyn, your mother-in-law?
I did not. Usually, though, I see Alfred more than I see Carolyn. I don't know if they have some kind of unspoken agreement in that way, but whenever, like, one of them's coming to pick Ellie up, it's usually him, or he's usually the first one out when I'm picking Ellie up myself. He's the one that greets me in the morning when I go to drop her off. I don't know why they arranged it that way. Maybe Carolyn doesn't like me, as is the mother-in-law stereotype.
Are you okay with having that in the podcast? I mean, she's going to hear this, right?
Probably, but I don't know. Does it make for better drama for it to be included? I don't know. I feel like I try to be really honest, and maybe it would be a way for us to talk about it. I think she knows I have kind of mixed feelings, just because like my strongest memory with her is the Christmas. I was so excited to give Ellie this Elmo doll. She was going to lose her shit. She was going to be so excited. And then I found out Carolyn bought the same doll, and Ellie opened it before the one that I had gotten her. I was just so upset. But anyway, like that in a nutshell is like how I feel about Carolyn. So
there's an interesting dynamic there.
I may just prepare her beforehand. Like, this is going to be honest, like brutally honest. And I talk about our relationship some. So
you got in the front passenger seat.
Yes.
Buckled in.
Yeah, he leaned the seat back a little bit, but yeah, I was in the front passenger seat.
Did Alfred seem a little nervous?
Oh, definitely. He had this look like walking on eggshells, or just like he seemed uncertain about everything. Like he kept looking to me almost like looking for confirmation or something.
And this is Alfred.
As I was helping Kara get in the car, I was feeling nervous because I'd never been nor experienced anything like this. I wanted to keep calm, stay relaxed for Kara's sake, and get her to the hospital as quickly as I could.
I don't know how many crises he's been a part of, but he definitely didn't feel very confident. I don't know if he was to the point where he wished he were anywhere but in that car, but at least he wasn't unfriendly and he wasn't overly pushy. And part of me is kind of glad that it was him. Carolyn couldn't believe it either. Jared told me that when he talked to her and he told her that the baby was coming, she had told him, no, that can't be. Tell her to stop. As if I could stop the contractions. Like, he's not supposed to come for a while. Tell her no.
She must be mistaken.
Yeah, it has to be something else. It's like, you've had 3 kids yourself. When have you been able to stop your contractions?
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
There aren't a whole lot of ways to get out of our small town. There's the back roads down Old Myrick, which are kind of bumpy and not well maintained. And then there's the more direct route up 380, which will take you pretty much right there to the highway. The bumpy, winding roads of Old Myrick and Bridge Farmer typically see less traffic just because of, I guess, a lot of people also don't like the bumps and the windiness. 380, though, is really unpredictable because it is the main way in and out of town. So it can be really backed up. Once it took me like 25 minutes just to go a mile. Traffic was so bad because it's also just like a 2-lane highway. So Alfred asked me which way or we should take. And I didn't trust myself on the bumpy roads. I thought it would just make everything feel worse. So I told him to take 380.
And as you traveled, Jared was on the phone over the car's speakers, like on Bluetooth.
Yes. Alfred called and had him talk to us because he was getting out of work. He scrubbed up right quick, you know, because he's a mechanic and just covered with oil all the time. And he was going to try and meet us. He said if he had taken his motorcycle, he would have definitely made it before Alex had come out. But he was in his truck, so it was going to take a little while.
So you and Alfred are racing to get to the hospital. Jared is racing also at the same time. But he was on the phone with you, so he could kind of hear what's going on.
Yes, he could hear me laboring, I guess, or he could hear me in pain. And I didn't know it at the time, but he told me later that he was timing it. Like, he could hear when I would cry out. And he would look at the clock and then he would wait for the next time. And so he put it together before I did, or at least acknowledged it before I was willing to acknowledge it, that the baby was coming, that these were real contractions. They were coming regularly, not sporadically like practice labor usually does. My hospital usually takes about 30 minutes to get to because I purposely wanted that one. It has, in my mind, a better reputation than the one that was closer. But we didn't make it that far. As we're going down 380, Jared is trying to figure out where we are. Alfred is trying to tell him, but he's given him like weird landmark, like, oh, I see this old rundown shed thing or whatever, and I'm just over here, you know, puffing and screaming and like, Bridge Farmer, 380. We're passing the intersection, so he knows where we are. Then we get up to airport, where we would turn off to get to the bigger highway that would take us to Baylor Centennial. And it's at that point Jared asks us, where are you taking her? I thought it was still understood. We were trying to go to the hospital we had planned to deliver it. Alfred says as much. And Jared says, like, no, you need to take her to Medical City McKinney, which is the closer hospital, which we were about 10 or 15 minutes away from. And so Alfred's asking how we get to there. And he missed the turn, makes a U-turn, which is good in my mind, because I think at the time, I don't think I would have had my mental map ready to redirect us or reroute us. So when we get on to airport, it's at that point that I can feel him crowning. Like, I reached down and I felt his head. And I realized that I needed to get my pants off. And I was able to shimmy them down to like around my hips and stuff. But I needed Alfred's help to get them any further. I was not going to be able to bend down enough to do that. So I told him that we needed to pull over. Well, told him this as best I could. I wasn't exactly like talking as civilly as we are right now.
Yeah, you were under a little bit of stress then.
Yeah, yeah. So I screamed at him, pull over, or I need help, or I think I need to take my pants off. I think that is literally what I said at one point. I think I need to take my pants off. So he's looking for places to pull over. I'm getting a little more irritated as we keep passing all these viable spots where he could have pulled over. And finally, I start screaming at him, help me. Help me. And he jumps the curb onto this like field so that he can get out of the car and help me actually get my pants off.
And of course, I had to ask Alfred, what were his thoughts at that time?
When Karen said to pull over and the baby's coming, now I thought, holy sugar. Once I jumped the curb to get off the street, I called 911 as I was running around the car to open the passenger door. I was listening to the 911 operator give me instructions and ask questions about Karen and the situation. This was not exactly the situation I wanted to be in.
I guess at some point while I was busy asking for help, he had called 911. So I guess he's got the dispatcher on the line. But he helps me with my pants. And it's not very long after that that just this one final wave of pain, and that it's almost like you know, those little like water plastic thingies that you see kids playing with. I don't know, it's like some kind of science thing. I think I had to look up what the heck they were called.
Like a water weenie, is that what they are?
Yeah. So anyway, that's what it feels like, that sensation of having it in your hands. That's what it felt like as he was coming out in this big horribly painful gush. I've never felt anything quite like that.
McKinney 911, what is the address of your emergency?
My daughter's in labor. She's, the baby's coming out. I'm trying to get her to the hospital. And what's over here on 121 and Elm.
Okay, sir, okay, you're on Elm? Elm?
What?
Where, you're at Elm and where? Okay, I understand that the baby is coming right now, but I need the baby's out. Okay. I need to find out where exactly you are.
I'm just off of airport.
Elm and airport?
Elm.
Okay.
Elm and Elm.
Okay. Are you in a vehicle?
Yes, a white Subaru.
White Subaru?
Forester.
Okay. All right. Okay. How old is your daughter?
This is my daughter-in-law. I'm 33.
Okay. Okay, I'm sending them to you right now, okay?
Okay, thank you.
Okay, hold on. We're going to stay on the line because I need to tell you exactly what to do now that the baby is out. The baby's completely out?
Yes, completely out, and the cord is still attached.
Okay, all right. Do you have a shoelace?
It's one of those twisty ones.
Okay. Is the baby crying or breathing?
He was crying a second ago.
Does it look like he's breathing?
I had to open the umbilical sash. It looks like he's breathing.
Okay, I need to know if the baby is breathing.
He seems like he's breathing.
Okay, do you have any kind of clean towel or cloth? Okay. We need to wipe off the baby's mouth and nose. That way we can get all of the amniotic fluid, any mucus, anything off the baby. That way the baby can breathe, okay? And then we need to get a clean towel cloth. That way we can dry the baby off and then wrap the baby in another one. Do you have anything clean, a blanket, a towel, a cloth, anything?
All I can do is the shirt off my back.
Okay. Okay, we just need to try to keep the baby comfortable, and we need to try to keep the baby's face clean. That way the baby can breathe, okay?
All right, I just have some Kleenex.
Okay, Yeah, if you have the Kleenex, you can just wipe off his mouth and nose, and then just try to clean around his head. That way we can get any mucus or amniotic fluid off of him, okay? And if you have anything that is clean that we can wrap the baby in?
Like I said, I mean, you know, like shirt on my back,
okay.
That's all I have.
Is she laying down in the back seat of the car?
Well, in the front seat, sort of laid back.
Okay, so without pulling the cord tight, we need to keep the baby down between the mother's legs level with her bottom, and we need to make sure the cord is not wrapped around the baby's neck, okay?
It is not.
Okay.
Face up or face down, or if he's
going to
be level with my bottom.
We need to keep him face up. Just keep him level with your bottom in between your legs if you can. And you said the cord is not wrapped around his neck, correct?
I've got 911 coming. Thank you.
Okay. All right, we're going to watch the baby closely for 3 minutes, and then we're going to try to find something to tie the cord with, okay?
Okay.
All right, so what I just want you to do for the next 3 minutes is monitor the baby. Let me know. I can hear the baby crying, which is great. So we're just going to monitor the baby for the next couple minutes. Let me know if anything looks strange, if the baby's having trouble breathing, if he's changing color, anything.
It doesn't look like he's changing color.
Okay, good. That we've got the paramedics almost there. They'll be with you in just a moment, okay? You're doing great. And do you have anything to tie the umbilical cord off with?
Not really.
Okay. They're almost there, so hopefully they can help you. Is it a boy or a girl?
It's a boy.
It's a boy.
Yeah.
Okay, you should be hearing the ambulance in just a moment.
Yeah, the fire truck just came around the corner.
Okay. I just want to make sure that they can get to you and find you before I let you go, okay? Has your afterbirth come out yet?
I don't think so.
Okay, you haven't pushed anything out besides the baby, correct?
I don't think so.
Okay.
Don't have anything.
Let me know when the paramedics are right there with you.
Breathing? Okay. We're breathing. We're good.
Ma'am, is the paramedic with you?
Okay,
I'm going to let you go. Congratulations.
And Alfred's right there. Was there even any time for either of you to be embarrassed about having a baby and it's your father-in-law that's assisting you?
Oh, thank goodness not. There is like next to no time.
We weren't even thinking about that. Okay.
No, I think I did have a moment where there were people passing us on the road. There was a brief moment where I thought, well, I guess they're going to get a show. I hope they can't really see me from over here because, like, the passenger side of the car was pointed away from the road. But I don't know. His window was wide open, so I don't know if anybody could see. We had a few people ask if we needed help. One guy even pulled up on the curb next to us, and I think he left by the time the EMTs arrived.
In that audio, it sounded like Alfred was talking to a few people who happened to stop by and offer help.
Yeah, I vaguely was aware of that, but once Alex was out, I was primarily focused on that, like holding him in my arms. Like I caught him after he came out. Alfred may have touched him too. I don't even remember. I don't really remember what the heck he was doing until I became more aware of the 911 dispatcher talking to us. Alex was in my arms and he was still in the sack. And at the time I was thinking, I wonder if he can still breathe in that and he needs to come out. And so I pinched it and just ripped it open.
This is the amniotic sac you're talking about.
That's right. Yeah. It was so slimy and just seemed like something out of a horror movie almost, you know?
So you just ripped it open?
Yes. So I ripped it open and pulled it off of him. And the cord was kind of snaked around him like some kind of crazy scarf. But he was breathing. He wasn't crying, really. I was concerned about the cord, so I just kind of pushed that to be out of the way because it was kind of around his neck and I was concerned. I think it was around that time that I became aware of the dispatcher talking to us on the phone because she was concerned that he wasn't crying. And so she told me to basically piss him off. So I held him down low until he started crying.
What did he look like at that point?
He looked slimy and covered with white specks. He had all his hair. His eyes were closed, and he looked so small, I guess, because he didn't have the time, you know, in the oven to put on all the chubby baby fat. I found out later he was like 7 pounds, 6 ounces, but everybody, when they saw him, they said, "He's so tiny. He's so tiny."
He was all slimy and covered in stuff. Did you feel the need that you had to clean him up?
The dispatcher was telling us to clean him up. And Alfred wanted to... He said he didn't have anything except the shirt off his back. And he mentioned that a couple times. And the dispatcher obviously didn't think that was acceptable. So Alfred said, "I've got Kleenex." And so I remember him going over to the driver's side and like wiping at Alex's face with the Kleenex as I was holding him to me. And then she started talking about if we had something to cut the umbilical cord. And that's what I was really worried about because I didn't have anything to cut the umbilical. I have like one very dull novelty pocket knife off my keys, and I didn't think that was going to be enough, and I definitely wouldn't want to do the, you know, what wild animals do and chew it off with their teeth. But fortunately by that time the EMTs had started arriving, so they were the ones that cut the cord, and the placenta was still inside me, so they didn't worry about that, I guess, until later, where they're like, "Oh yeah, we got to do something about that."
Now, during this whole thing, was Jared still on the phone with you?
No, he arrived, I think, shortly after the EMTs got there, because he says that he remembers seeing the inside of the car. And since Alfred was the one coherent enough to make calls, when Alfred had called 911, Jared, I guess that was when he was talking to his mom and telling her that the baby was coming.
But somehow he knew where you had pulled over, though.
I guess Alfred had told him where we were going to be right before he ended the call and called 911. The EMTs asked me if it was okay for the baby to go in an ambulance, like the first ambulance. They said that they were going to send another one for me to ride in. Maybe they thought that I was going to be like a grizzly bear and just, "No, the baby has to arrive with me. You can't have him." But I was so just worn out and just glad that he seemed to be okay. I let him go to the hospital, or I didn't put up a fuss, at least. He went in the first ambulance, and Jared, I can't remember that point. He followed the ambulance in his truck, and then I went in the second ambulance shortly thereafter.
And did Alfred also take his car and go to the hospital as well?
He did. Unfortunately for him, I guess, because then it got to sit in the parking lot for hours in the hot, hot sun, have all that wonderful, disgusting human fluid and blood and all that stuff just bake into his passenger seat.
Talk about your ambulance ride.
They kept asking me like the same questions, like my name and the baby's name is, and how far along was I? And at one point somebody asked me like if I was thirsty. I was just like, yeah, I mean, it's Texas, it's summer. I was just laboring. Yes, I'm thirsty. And so I guess they don't have water bottles on the ambulance they could just give me. So they gave it directly to my veins via this like heavy duty hookup with the tape that will last past the apocalypse.
It was, so you got an IV.
Yes, I got an IV.
With hydration. Okay.
We're in the ambulance, and it's from where we ended up on airport to the hospital. It's like literally 5 minutes. So it wasn't a very long ambulance ride.
Man, you almost made it.
We almost made it. Instead, we arrived at their doorstep with the baby like, here it is. I did all the work without you. So as we're pulling up to the emergency room entrance, I feel this one final need to push and a last scream as I push out the placenta. And one of the EMTs bags it up. We get onto a gurney, I guess, and they start wheeling me into the delivery room for the doctor to inspect me and everything. One of the EMTs brings along the placenta. I don't know if he was expecting us to want to save it, I guess, for the cord blood, or, you know, I hear some people eat that or something in some cultures. I don't know. One of the nurses there thought she was, you know, it was comedy night, I guess, or she wanted to add some brevity to the room or something. They heard that we were coming. The ambulance or the EMTs had phoned ahead or something, letting them know to expect us. So she was quick to ask me if Alfred was, my father-in-law, was traumatized. She said that I owe him a stiff drink, which I still haven't given him.
So when you were examined and everything was good?
Yeah, surprisingly. When I was pregnant, my doctor had told me there was like a 44% chance that I would have a successful VBAC or vaginal birth after C-section. I guess they have some kind of formula based on my age and my weight and my gestational diabetes and my previous C-section history. This was going to be a planned C-section, and it ended up being a VBAC after all, just as I was hoping for.
Right, because recovery is a lot quicker for what you did rather than a surgery. Yeah.
Not to mention you can never be sure how good the surgeon that you get. Like, the surgeon I had for my first one was outstanding, apparently, because all the doctors that see it are like, wow, she did such a good job stitching you back up. I don't see any horrible scars or whatever. I don't know. I'll take your word for it. It looks good. The doctor in the delivery room said that everything looked good. Nothing was torn. He had to torture me some more by really pushing down on there, I guess, to feel where my uterus was. And I guess after he was done prodding me enough, and he said everything was good to go and we could head on to a post-labor room before too long. And we hung out in there for quite a while before they put us in a post-delivery room. And I finally got to hold my baby right after he was born, because I missed out on that with Ellie. I wasn't able to hold her for the first 48 hours.
And this happened not that long ago. How old is Alex now?
He's a month now. He's going to be 2 months on October 7th. Yeah, when we went for our one-month checkup, he was almost 10 pounds.
Has Alfred recovered from the shock of being there when it happened?
I don't know if he'll ever fully recover from that. It's something he's never experienced before, and he'll probably never experience anything quite like it ever. Maybe he'll have a nice bond with Alex when he's older, you know, that they'll be closer than they ever would have been.
You left in his car. You left your pants and your underwear. That passenger seat. Can you describe that?
Everything was soaked through with the amniotic fluid and the blood. And I'm told that other women will sometimes have, you know, like urine or whatever as well, because, you know, everything wants to push. So you just empty everything. I didn't have that, thankfully, but Alfred tells me the smell was awful. I have next to no sense of smell naturally, so I don't really remember much of a smell anyway. But it was soaked through all through the seat warmers and everything. And my husband, being a mechanic and feeling guilty that I ruined his seat, offered to pay for and perform the swap. So now Alfred has practically a brand new passenger seat.
I wondered what Alfred thought when he got back home and looked at that and thought, okay, I got to start working on this.
I got back home and started the process of cleaning the passenger seat of the car. What a mess and the smell. Oh my goodness. Initially, I pulled the car into the garage, but because of the odor, I backed it out, lowered all the windows, and found a pair of disposable gloves and started the cleaning process. The whole time I was thinking, thank goodness tomorrow's garbage day.
No, I'm sure he was already thinking about selling the whole car, you know, easier than cleaning it out.
Final question. Any advice for mothers who are currently on their second pregnancy?
Well, on the second one, and I had heard this too, but I didn't give it much thought. On subsequent births, the process is usually faster. You usually don't labor as long as with the previous ones. So maybe just do some research of in case you're somewhere that's not a hospital room and you might have to handle some things on your own. Like even having a towel in the car probably would have been helpful. Something to hold the baby in, but definitely have a backup plan in case you can't make it to your hospital. If I'd known what it was going to be like, maybe I would have just had the baby at home if I'd known enough about how to do a home delivery, because then we could have just had the ease of driving up to the hospital of our choice and like, here it is, here's the baby. Then I would have been able to see my doctor. She didn't have the practicing rights at the hospital we ended up at, so I wasn't even able to see her at all. I got a new doctor every day that I was there.
Anything that we haven't talked about that you want to include?
I had to cancel my own C-section. For some reason, nobody, even though everyone had heard of my doctor, heard of my hospital, they kept telling me they were going to tell her. Nobody told her. Until I had asked her after the fact, like a lactation question, and asked her about the C-section. Like, I'm still getting notices, reminders that the C-section is coming up, but I've had the baby. Do I need to call the hospital and tell them to cancel the C-section? And by then she put two and two together and she told me she was going to cancel the C-section, obviously, because it was no longer needed. But I still ended up having to do that anyway. Even the day of, they were trying to remind me about the C-section.
It's a fun story to tell, and it has a happy ending. So congratulations on number two.
Thank you.
I want to say a big thanks to Karen's stepmom, Dawn. She's a What Was That Like listener, and she had the idea and suggested to Karen to get in touch with me to tell this story. So thanks, Dawn. And if you're wondering what Alfred's car seat looked like afterward, you can see pictures of it in the episode notes. And of course, you can see pictures of baby Alex. That's all at whatwasthatlike.com/153. And if you like this episode, you might like listening to episode 91 from a couple of years ago. It's 17 different women, all of them listeners to this podcast, telling their unusual childbirth stories. That's at whatwasthatlike.com/91. And now I have to talk about a recent episode and what happened afterward. A couple of shows back, my guest was Laura. The title of that one was Laura's Pain Became Her Purpose. And the topic of that show was the tragedy of children who die after being accidentally left in a hot car. Laura told the story of losing her 18-month-old son, Anderson, that way. And she actually lost even more than that. It's not an easy story to listen to, but it's a very important one for everyone to hear. And after that episode came out, the listeners in the Facebook group had a lot to say. And I mean a lot. If you're in that group, you saw it. The huge outpouring of support and love for Laura was just mind-blowing. Comment after comment about her courage in telling that story, the effect it had, just so much emotion and compassion from everyone after hearing Laura talk about what happened. One listener, Jenny, sent me this voicemail.
Hi, Scott. This is Jenny. Laura's story was extremely heartbreaking to listen to. Just like a lot of other parents or just anybody, I used to be one of those people that could not imagine how anybody could ever leave their child in a car or forget that their child was with them. After all, that's your child. How do you forget they're in the car, right? Well, it can happen. It happened to me. I was just one of the lucky ones where it did not end in a tragedy. It was when my son was about 3 years old. He went to a preschool program that was a 3 days a week, 2.5 hour program. And he was quite the chatterbox at that age. So our routine was I would drive him to daycare. He would talk up a storm. Then I would drop him off. And when I picked him up, he would talk up a storm on the way home again. The only time it was ever really silent in the car was my ride home after dropping him off. So this one day, I dropped him off, went about my business, then I came to pick him up. And he must have been just extra tired that day. For whatever reason, that entire drive home, he did not say a word. He was completely silent. So before I knew it, my brain was automatically in drop-off mode. I didn't hear a sound, so my brain just knew, okay, I just dropped off my son. I pulled into our driveway at home and saw a flower delivery, just a package with flowers right outside my door. And I was so excited because it's not every day that you get flowers. And I hopped out of the car, I locked the car, I ran to the door, grabbed my flowers and went into the house. My husband came, he had been working from home. He had sent me the flowers, but hadn't noticed them yet. And we went into the kitchen where I arranged the flowers and we chatted. And a few minutes later, we both at the same time realized that our son wasn't there. And I felt all the blood drain from my face. And I ran outside and I unlocked the door and there was my son in his car seat crying. And he said, "You are supposed to hear me." And my heart broke. And in that moment, I realized how quickly it can happen that you forget your child in the car. I was one of those people that could have never imagined, and here I was and just forgot my child in the car. I was so lucky that, for one, it wasn't midsummer, it was late spring. And secondly, that I noticed after about 5 minutes, it could have really easily been me that had caused a tragedy. I am to this day so thankful that I noticed in time. And I'm feeling ashamed that I ever looked down on those parents that forgot their child in the car, because it does happen. And yes, it can happen to you. And I want to say to Laura, you are an amazing and strong woman. And thank you for all the hard work you do.
If you haven't yet listened to Laura's story in episode 151, I encourage you to do so. And then join in the conversation in the Facebook group at whatwasthatlike.com/Facebook. If you'd like to support the show and get extra 911 audio episodes and all of the episodes without any ads, it's super easy and you can try it out for free. And a lot of listeners have already done that. On your iPhone, just go to the What Was That Like podcast feed and click on Try Free. If you're on Android, go to whatwasthatlike.com/plus. There are 35 bonus episodes waiting for you to binge, and episode 36 will be out in just a week from now. Graphics for this episode were created by Bob Bretz. Full episode transcription was created by James Lai. And now, the listener story. We love our listener stories. And this is how we end every episode, with a story that was sent in by a listener. If you want to hear your voice here on this podcast, think of something that happened to you that was memorable in some way. Then record a roughly 5 to 10 minute story on your phone and send it to me, scott@whatwasthatlike.com. This week's story is from a friend of mine, Callista. It's about a major medical situation that happened to her at an unusually young age. And a couple of days from now, Callista will be having her 3-year celebration. It's what she calls her stroke-iversary. So Callista, congratulations on surviving and thriving. Stay safe, and I'll see you here soon. A week from now, we'll have Raw Audio 36, and on the same Friday, a bonus episode of What Was That Like? And it's going to be ad-free for everyone.
On October 21st, 2019, I woke up feeling good. It was my favorite month. I had just quit my barista job 2 days before, and I had new job interviews lined up that were related to my arts management degree from College of Charleston, where I graduated from the previous May. I was still living in Charleston, South Carolina, but that day I had to drive down to Myrtle Beach to take care of some errands with my mom. I had a nice 2-hour drive, and when I arrived, we went to lunch and then went to the Sprint store as we both needed new phones. As the Sprint employee is explaining our options, I begin to feel odd. My anxiety kicks in a bit, but before I can get any more worried, I begin to see ripples in my vision. At this point, I excuse myself and go out and sit in the car. The ripples go away, but a headache settles in. I call and talk to my roommates, and they say maybe I'm just tired or dehydrated. My mom handles our phones and then drives us home. I take an Advil and nap for a couple of hours, and when I wake up, decide I feel a bit better and I'd like to sleep in my own bed, so I get in the car and start my drive back to Charleston. Halfway through, I momentarily lose the use of my right arm and leg. I couldn't even process the way it felt. I pull over at a Dollar General and go inside, splash some water on my face, and buy a Gatorade. But as I'm talking to the cashier, I get the bizarre notion that the words coming out of my mouth don't really match the thoughts in my head, but I can't be sure, so I continue driving home. Once I get home, I tell my roommates I'm going to lie down again. When I wake up around 8 p.m., my roommate had texted me, and as I reply, I can't quite write what I'm trying to say, and the sentences I send are incomplete or jumbled. Eventually, my sentences become more complete, and I text my best friend, Aika, and ask her if I can stay the night at her house, particularly because she had an extra bed in her room, which made me feel safer if I started to feel worse through the night. Aika picks me up, we eat dinner at her house, and chit-chat for a while. We agree that it's probably just my anxiety causing all of these symptoms, and I go to sleep feeling completely normal. The next morning, which also happened to be Aika's birthday, we wake up and she says she's going to class, but she'll be back shortly in case I'm not feeling well and would like to go get checked out by a doctor for good measure. I try to respond to her, but realize I can't form a complete sentence. And when she brings me a glass of water, I can't lift it to my mouth without spilling it everywhere. At this point, Ika says she's taking me to the hospital now instead of later. After stumbling to the bathroom and being guided down the stairs, I try to put my shoes on, but struggle to the point that I'm lying down. Ika decides it will be too hard to get me to the hospital, so she calls 911. When they arrive, they try asking me when the symptoms started, and I respond tomorrow instead of yesterday. They have me take some deep breaths and take my pulse, and comment that they just think I'm having a panic attack, and that my blood pressure is normal. They have a choice between two nearby hospitals and choose one at random. When we get there and a doctor comes in, he's uncomfortably jovial and chuckles when I'm unable to shake his hand because I don't have control of mine. He runs no simple tests for someone with my symptoms and tells Ika and I that sometimes severe anxiety can cause these symptoms. They hook me up to an IV of Ativan and tell Ika I'll be fine. But luckily, she had called my mom, who was on her way from Myrtle Beach by this point. When I woke up after the Ativan, I was coherent enough to read my mom's texts, but not to walk or talk. They ask if they should call me an Uber, and I express in my best broken sentences that my mom is on the way. They decide to wheel me into the waiting room where finally, my mom is able to find me after searching when the front desk said they were unsure where I was. I can't lift my head up, say very much, or use my hand, and my mom is startled by my condition. She goes back and finds the doctor, who refuses to run any tests, and assures my mom that this is just an anxiety attack. My mom takes me to my apartment for about 30 minutes, but ultimately decides something isn't right and takes me to the other hospital. They immediately admit me and run every test possible, MRIs, heart ultrasounds, and more. Time passes, and in the middle of the night, they let us know their conclusion. An ischemic stroke, with the blood clot being caused by the dissection of my carotid artery. Obviously, not normal for someone my age, at 22 years old. The doctors have remained undecided about the cause of the carotid artery dissection, despite being tested for various genetic disorders and autoimmune diseases, so for now, I take a daily 325 milligram aspirin and have regular checkups. It was a long road to recovery. The first few days in the hospital, it was tough to answer simple questions like what month it was and what my name was. After a couple of weeks, I was moved to a rehabilitation center to learn how to walk, talk, and write again. And while I still struggle with various effects like brain fog, occasional headaches, and my hand not being able to write quite as fast as my brain wants it to, I'm lucky that my brain recovered as well as it did, and I'm able to live a great, fulfilling life thanks to the doctors, family members, and friends that took my symptoms seriously and got me the help that I needed.